Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Solari Report. This is Money and Markets with John Titus and Catherine Austin Fitz. We're recording on December 7th, Wednesday, for publication tomorrow on December 8th. This Christmas season has started. I'm wearing red, and we hope you're going to have a wonderful season. We've got plenty to talk about today, including our theme.
The fairy tale inflation is which is raging during the Christmas season.
Everybody should buy fairy tale books for their Christmas stuffing, you know, their stockings, because
they're fairy
Well, here's the thing. The inflation is not just the official narrative. It's in the independent media, too. I mean, it's
out of control.
It's out of control. Yeah. So financial inflation is followed by narrative inflation. And we have plenty of fairy tales to unpack today.
Yeah, let's just get it going, because it's right from the beginning. Starting with the first couple of stories, let's start with war in Ukraine and get right into it. And the first couple of stories, I don't really need to go a little bit past the headline, but not much. Wall Street Journal, U.S. altered HIMARS rocket launchers to keep Ukraine from firing missiles into Russia, okay? So that's the journal story. Look when this came out, all right? December 5th at 10 a.m. All right. So the U.S. is altering these rockets to prevent Ukraine from firing missiles into Russia, right? That's
so you notice in the first sentence it says secretly modified.
Yeah, that's a very good catch.
Secretly
modified, right? Okay. It's a big secret.
Yeah.
Okay, well let's go to the next story from the New York Times. Missiles targeted Ukraine's energy grid. That's not the important part. Blast reported at two bases in Russia. Well, I thought they had modified the rockets.
Well that's how you can tell that it wasn't the U.S. weapons that were used, right?
Right. That's how you know. And if you look here, you can see the timestamp on this story, December 5th. It says 10:24 a.m. So at 10 a.m., at 10 a.m., we learned that the U.S. has secretly modified the rockets to prevent missiles from flying into Russia. And 24 minutes later, what happens?
Wow. What a coincidence.
Insider. Yeah. Isn't that amazing?
Yeah, it's amazing. It's just amazing. Yeah.
Incredible. But let's go to, that takes us to our first set of charts, right?
Right.
Let's take a look. World's largest arm producing companies.
So this is 2021, and the U.S. is by far the largest exporter of arms in the world. Russia's number two. I was expecting, John, that the sales would be dramatically up in the U.S. companies. And you can see you've got U.S., you've got
Raytheon's up.
Yeah, Raytheon's the weather warfare.
Yeah.
The guys
who do
weather.
This is 2020 to 2021. That's the change.
Right. So we would expect it to be higher this year. I expected much higher numbers. And now, here's what you need to remember with FASB 56. Who knows whether these numbers are meaningful or not? This is just their official narrative. But the reason I wanted to look at this chart was I thought it was interesting to see we have two Chinese companies with dramatic increases. Now, we know the Chinese military is growing, but we also know they're trading around the world. And we also know the Russian energy is going to make them more competitive in the arms market. So I thought that was I just wanted to note that, you know, we don't necessarily know what that means yet, but I think it's important.
Yeah. I think that is important. Let's see. Is there anything else in that chart? No. But anyway, that's a key thing.
Right.
Is those companies now, you know, who knows whether, you know, Raytheon goes up in anticipation of you know, the Russia special military operation. I don't know.
So one of the reasons I think I thought the arms manufacturers was interesting because we talked last week about the fact that the part of the Chinese leadership that makes money on war is rising in power, and it's cutting into the action of the guys who make money on trading.
Yeah.
You know, and that's part of the tensions we're seeing with the protests in China. And you can see for the guys, you know, I keep getting asked the question, why is there such a push to do all these things if it shrinks the economy? And I point out it doesn't shrink the economy for the people doing it.
Right.
Right.
Exactly.
Right.
Exactly. They do not care if the whole pie shrinks.
Right.
As long as their slice gets bigger.
I told you the famous quote from the HUD Inspector General's office. The Inspector General is the agency auditor. So the Deputy Assistant Secretary said, but, you know, if we do that, we'll lose, you know, we make a lot more money if we sell a mortgage than if we hold it. If we hold it out of sale so that you can do a civil money penalty, we'll lose millions and millions of dollars. And the auditor says, yeah, but we don't get that money, so we don't care.
Yeah. Right.
You know, right.
But that encapsulates that mindset really well.
Right. At the time they said that, $100,000 was the approximate total amount that the average American paid in federal taxes in a lifetime of working. So,
yeah,
you know, every time they lose $1 million in the mortgage, that's 10 tax lives down the drain.
Yeah,
and they didn't care. Right.
They don't care. Right. Right. Okay, let's keep it going. War in Ukraine. You know, there's the war on the ground with missiles and whatnot. But then there's the financial and asset war, and that's the next story I find kind of interesting. EU testing legal options to use frozen Russian central bank assets for Ukraine reconstruction. And you can see here, we have blocked 300 billion euros of the Russian central bank reserves, and we have frozen 19 billion euros of oligarchs' money. Ursula von der Leyen said in a statement this week, she goes on, we will work on an international agreement with our partners to make this possible. And this is the part I find interesting. And together, we can find basically legal ways to steal their money,
right,
which I find really interesting because later on in the story, you see, yeah, there's legal roadblocks to doing what von der Leyen has in mind. And Yellen points out, starting months ago, that confiscating Russian state assets should not be done lightly and should be carried out only in coordination with allies, and it might require legislation in the U.S. What I find so curious about all of this is this concern by these officials like von der Leyen and Yellen with the gloss of legality.
Right.
What are they worried about? Why not just steal the assets like you want to? You're going to do it anyway.
Because if you steal it, if you just steal it, then anybody else can do the same if you just steal it. So
right.
If stealing is now permitted, then the whole central bank reserve system moves to a level of insecurity that can't be tolerated.
Right. I think that's right. Why, I think that's right. Part of it. I think the other part of it is that really there's a lot of stuff going on. You know, Russia has not declared war on Ukraine.
Right.
Right. So there's your justification here is a little thin because they haven't declared war yet.
Well, the other thing is the Russian central bank is not the Russian government.
Right.
Right.
Well, okay. But you can't treat Russia really there's no war. They haven't declared war.
Right. But remember, if you can seize a central bank's assets to punish the government, then everyone in the world can seize the New York Fed's assets to punish the U.S. government. Do you know what I mean?
Right.
It's open field running. The other thing is what I read Yellen saying is you can't seize their assets unless you cut us in for a piece. So
that could
we
be
have
part
to,
of it.
Well, but if you look at the, you know, the rumors on the Iran deal, it's not only cutting all the different countries in for a piece, but all the people in the positions who agree to it for the appropriate kickbacks.
Yeah.
So I will bet you any amount of, you know, I will bet you my Christmas bonus that it's going to be negotiations, including kickbacks in people's offshore accounts.
Yeah, I wouldn't take that. I wouldn't touch that action with my worst enemy's 10-foot pole. Forget it.
Right.
No.
Yeah.
Okay, let's keep it going. This next story is kind of interesting, too, from military.com. So this is more or less an official source. EU seeks specialized court to investigate, you know, here we go, Russian war crimes. Well, you know, okay. So what's going on here? The EU proposed Wednesday to set up a UN-based specialized court to investigate possible war crimes, even though there's no declared war, committed by Russia in Ukraine. And then you go down farther, investigation of military crimes committed during, you know, they keep pumping this notion of war in Ukraine are underway around Europe. and the Hague-based International Criminal Court has already launched investigations. What do you think's going on in that story?
So I think there are a couple of things going on. I think what is happening in the Ukraine is the Ukraine is being depopulated and will be, you know, you saw that video of sort of their vision of the Ukraine in 2030. So you move all the people who are there out, you take over the land, and then you rebuild with you owning the equity now, and you need money to rebuild. Now, given how much money has been being pumped into the Ukraine, you're not going to get that money if you ask people to appropriate it in the West. They're going to have a hard time explaining why they should build, you know, the mansion in the sky for these other people. You know, what does that have to do with, you know, the war is an easier justification than the rebuild for a group of private people who want their own country now. Okay, so you've got a real optics problem. And one way is to just say, well, we're going to use the Russians' money. To take the Russians' money, you have to come up with a legal subterfuge, as we just discussed. You've got to come up with one where everybody gets cut into the actions, like the wolf pack, so they all go along. But then you need a moral justification. And oftentimes, when you're going to subvert the rule of law, you need, you know, the dying babies in the incubator to give you the, you know, the emotional pull to say it's okay. You want people to say they deserve to lose their money because what they did was really horrible and it's okay. So you need sort of a moral spin and a public spin to overlay what you're doing. And in politics, that is much more important than you might think.
Yeah, well, it reminds me, what you just said reminds me of Gangs of New York. Did you see that movie back in the early 2000s? Gangs of New York, there's a scene with the boss of Tammany Hall, and he says, you know, listen, the law must be upheld. The appearance of the law must be upheld, especially when you're about to break it.
Right.
Yeah. Right.
But you need, you know, it's I go back to Wag the Dog. Remember the woman in the Shaw with the baby running for a life? You need that picture. You didn't see it? You need that picture that just makes people, you know, I used to have a friend who would call marketing to the four chakra people, the people like, oh God, that's so horrible. Why did they, you know, you got to have that. You got to have something that tugs on the heartstrings. So that's what they're going to, they're going to do the Russian war crimes, and they're going to get everybody just literally hating the Russians for these horrible things they did.
I think another part of it, and perhaps a small part of that story about war crimes and trials and whatnot, is a bit of propaganda in that you really, you know, to really conduct those trials, you have to win the war, right?
Right.
The Nuremberg trials weren't conducted by Germany. They tried Germany. They were conducted by the winners. So that's sort of the backdrop to two. It's more of the same, like we're winning this war and they're going to pay for it.
This is the 21st century. We don't need to win to pretend we won.
Right.
Right.
Right. Right. It's fairy tale inflation. Okay. It's more of the same. Okay.
Yep.
Let's keep going. Next story from Thierry Meyssan, Voltaire.net. This is a long piece on the plurality of information can prevent war. I'm going to just grossly oversimplify it. After the Second World War, modern international law was established with the idea of countering war propaganda. Everybody agreed that war could only be fought against by ensuring the free flow. You could only prevent war by fighting against the free. You need to ensure the free flow of ideas.
Right.
In recent years, however, we have seen extraordinary backsliding to where we were back in World War II with private censorship and public censorship. And then he goes on and on and on and on. And basically, look at this. He says, and what's happened? Trust in newspapers has fallen from 51% to 16%. And radio and TV has fallen from 46% to 11%. So it's basically been, you know, anywhere, it's lost anywhere between 2/3 to 3/4. And he says, the only solution is to increase the number of news agencies, i.e. the sources of information, because right now we have three. There's UPI, there's AP, and then there's Reuters.
Reuters, right.
The AFP. It's Agency France Press.
Right.
The UPI, and then there's Reuters, and that's it. So there's three. There's U.S., Britain, and France, and that's it.
Right. But I also think if you create another corporate infrastructure, it won't help. There's too much money and pressure on those mechanisms to do what they're told.
The corporations are too big and their banks are even bigger.
Right.
So it's not really going to help you. I agree.
Right. I don't think it's going to help.
Who cares if it's three or eight? It's not going to matter. They're all going to get on board.
The one thing I've seen over the last 10 years is the best intelligence comes in from thousands of people on the ground in a way that's totally out of control. Yeah. And it's that open marketplace of on-the-ground intelligence by the people really experiencing whatever it is that is so valuable for not every event, but many, many events. If it wasn't for that, I would have far less confidence in my assessment of what was going on. Because it's the only way you get the richness of the complexity.
Right. The only way to really extract information from mainstream media news stories is to ask yourself, what does the story mean to me in terms of what I'm supposed to believe?
Right.
Right.
Well, I always say cui bono. I just always look at how the money works on the situation. Right. That's how I do it. Right.
Right. Yep. Okay. Let's move to space military global turf wars and continuing our theme of fairy tale inflation. Here we go. NASA awards $57 million contract to build roads on the moon.
Right. And
that
$57 million is to basically write up your plans on how you would do it if you could.
Yeah, exactly. Right. Here's the key sentence. This is all you need to know. The contract goes to 2028. So the $57 million part is real, and you got plenty of time to build those roads. $57 million is not going to pay for the Uber to the moon, okay?
Right.
So it's just an in-your-face giveaway to me.
Well, here's the question. Within that contract, so the company is an expert in 3D printing. Within that contract, are they going to design or develop things that are going to be used for other purposes?
Yeah.
Yeah. So
most certainly they are. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Okay. Let's keep it going. The next story is interesting. This is Apple in China. Okay. From the Wall Street Journal. Apple plans to move production out of China. I just want to key on a couple of interesting things in this story to summarize it. Turmoil at a place called iPhone City helped propel Apple's shift out of China. At the giant city within a city at Zhengzhou, China, as many as 300,000 workers at a factory. Okay. I've worked in a factory before. My factory had 300, not 300,000.
Right.
300,000 factory run by Foxconn to make iPhones and other Apple products. At one point, this factory of 300,000 people made 85% of the Pro lineup of iPhones, according to market research firm Counterpoint. But this factory was convulsed in late November by violent protests. And now, because of these protests, Apple no longer feels comfortable having so much of its business in one place. Imagine that.
Right.
So out they go. What do you think of that?
I think there's a real fraying of the trade relationships with China. And what's interesting is it's happening at the same time that we're swinging the Russian oil to China. So China's getting lots more cheap oil and energy. You know, and my question is that energy swinging to China or is it swinging to Walmart? Because it's just going to keep the price of, you know, the goods at Walmart competitive. So it's interesting that China that iPhone is leaving. And my guess is if you look at the competition they're having with Huawei and the direct competitors, the politics of that are getting dangerous to them.
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, Apple opposes those, but they don't like the protests in China when it cuts into their bottom line.
Well, they turned off the airdrop. Two weeks ago, they turned off the airdrop to slow the protests down. So, right.
So they don't like this protest. But yet, if the same protest, when they're protesting the lockdowns and whatnot, you know, American and Canadian officials are all on board. They're all, we're in favor of that. That's good. Right. But protests that cut iPhone sales? No, no, no. Those are bad protests. I mean, it's just so, it's just completely unprincipled. Anyway, let's move on to FedWatch.
Centralization. This is where centralization goes.
Yeah. Right. It's just, right. It is where centralization goes, where one person's making this completely arbitrary and capricious decision. What you just saw there is a demonstration of there's no rule of law. You know, they just willy-nilly decide what to do.
This is what we talked about with Disney. You have a company leadership which is acting absolutely against the best interests of its shareholders.
Right. Right.
I mean,
we'll see another story later about that.
Right. Right.
Yep. Okay. To FedWatch we go, and back to our good buddy, Sam Bankman-Fried, the Wall Street Journal. FTX founder Sam Bankman-Fried says he can't account for billions sent to Alameda. Now, this story here from the Journal embodies what I hate about this guy's interview tour. Sam says he couldn't rule out the possibility that money deposited by FTX customers, who were told their money was theirs alone, was in fact lent to Alameda. In an interview with the Wall Street Journal, Mr. Bankman-Fried distanced himself from Alameda. Well, you know, the issue is, Sam, did the money disappear from their accounts or didn't it?
Right.
And if it did, which we know it did, and you know it did,
it's your
when
bad.
Did that happen? And he, right. when did it happen? And he won't answer these questions. And the Journal and the New York Times with this guy, Aaron Ross Sorkin, they go right along with this. And they never pin this guy down on anything. They let him just do give these speeches. And he never asked any question.
Right. Well, basically what he's saying is it was his girlfriend's fault.
Yeah, because sunspots. He did a story changes minute to minute. You know, but he never answers like, hey, when did the money start leaving the accounts? It's not in their accounts now, Sam. When did it start going?
Right. And who approved it?
Well, you know, the thing is. Yeah, exactly.
That transfer can't happen unless he approves it.
Right. He has to know about it anyway. Okay. Next story in FedWatch. This is really interesting. You flagged this one, and I looked a little bit more at this. BIS analysis shines light on persistent risks in foreign exchange trades. Hidden dollar debt. That's the key here. Hidden dollar debt. This is the BIS quarterly review. Okay. What are we talking about here? So this is foreign exchange. Let me try that one more time. Foreign exchange swap positions point to over $80 trillion of hidden U.S. dollar debt reported off-balance sheet, growing off-balance sheet U.S. dollar borrowing in the form of foreign exchange swaps, forwards, and currency swaps. You know, it amounts to $80 trillion worldwide. But if you drill down into this report,
right,
what you'll find is that $39 trillion of that $80 trillion is in dollar-denominated debt. Okay, right. $39 trillion of that is in banks headquartered outside the U.S.
Right.
So
it's a bubble.
They're forecasting to me, we've seen again and again and again, all these currencies weakening against the dollar bear trap. And the BIS is now saying, yeah, well, it's a $40 trillion trap.
Right.
They're basically saying there's a crisis on the way. That's how I read that.
Right.
Do you agree with that?
So I think the crisis is now. I mean, we're already in the crisis. It's just that the pain is not being expressed. There's a lot of pain going on that's not getting expressed. So I read this article several times. And normally in the old days, I would have just picked up the phone and called Rob Kirby and got him to unpack it for me. Because the thing I cannot understand about what the BIS is saying is, when you have these kinds of swaps, you have a notional value and then you have a net value. And you know, within that, you have positions which are fully hedged and are not. Now, you know, one side of a trade can break down in a fully hedged position. So I'm not saying it's risk-free, but there's no way to tell that I can tell from this article to really get at whether or not you have a net hidden U.S. debt position expressed in this book. Now, I'm sure you do, but I couldn't figure out how you would prove that or what the real numbers are. So these are positions that can be made out to look terribly more frightening than they need to be. Now, what I believe is happening is I believe the U.S. is hiding off-balance sheet debt. I know they're doing off-balance, I should say, I'm absolutely convinced that they've been doing off-balance sheet debt for quite a long time. And I'm sure some of it is hidden in this book, but I have no way of knowing. And that's why when people say, well, how could they have stolen $21 trillion? You know, if you can issue all the debt you want and print right. all the currency you want, you know, the sky's the limit. The question right. is, how do you hide the bubble? And in these kind of offshore pools or non-financial institutions, that's where you hide the bubble. You just got to keep it floating.
Right. Right. Okay. Anyway, I think the BIS is saying.
Well, but I think that you've got a squabble going on between the BIS and the Americans. Because this comes out right after the Pentagon is missing $2 trillion in can't do it books. And the BIS just happens to come out with something and saying, oh, there's $85 trillion of missing money and, you know, in offshore. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, this is, could be.
Somebody's could lobbing be. In a missile.
You know, if you look at Powell's phone logs, which you can check on St. Louis FRED database, not in the FRED, but St. Louis website. Frazier, I think it's called, which I check his phone call. They say they publish them monthly. There's mm-hmm. a couple month delay. Every month, he's on the phone with Carstens for an hour.
Of course.
Every month.
Right.
He's not on the phone with the IMF. He's not on the phone with Kristalina or Lagarde. Every time, Carstens, though.
Well, if I'm right, that's his money laundering pipe. Right?
Or they're setting up CBDC. It could be a lot of things. Anyway.
Yeah. Right.
But let's keep it going with FedWatch. This next story is interesting, and we'll cut to a video after this next story because this one, hard to swallow. Why it's hard to buy deodorant in Manhattan, okay? And they tell you right here, here's the official line. It's organized retail crime gangs are behind a shoplifting strike. Interesting. Organized retail crime gangs. Not organized wholesale crime gangs like central banks. Oh, no. No, the central banks are not causing... The most stolen items, including deodorant, laundry detergent, razors, infant formula, which goes into crystal meth, which are in consistent demand and are easy to sell, easy to pass on. So that's who they're blaming, okay? It's organized retail crime gangs. I now want to cut over to Janet Yellen, who's interviewed on the issue of inflation. Let's take a look and see what she says about who's to blame for this inflation. She doesn't blame organized retail crime gangs. Listen to who she blames. Very curious. Here we go.
Can you explain how inflation got so high? Because 2 years ago, everything seemed fine. Even in 2021, and you and other members of the administration believed that inflation was a small risk. What happened, simply and clearly?
That's a challenge.
That is, yeah.
So we had a rapid recovery from the pandemic. When President Biden was elected, unemployment was quite high. It was close to 7%. And we put policies in place that generated a very rapid recovery. Unemployment quickly fell back into the threes.
Where is it now?
3.7.
Okay.
So normally you wouldn't expect just because you had a rapid recovery for inflation to rise very much, if at all. But it turned out the pandemic had very special impacts on the economy. Remember, everybody stopped spending on services. They were in their homes for a year or more. They wanted to buy grills and office furniture. They were working from home. They suddenly started splurging on goods, buying technology. We're suddenly working through technology. And bottlenecks started developing where supply in particular important sectors of the economy just couldn't keep up with demand.
Yeah. Consumers splurging on technology. That it's not retail crime gangs, Catherine. It's consumers splurging on technology so much so that the manufacturers can't keep up with it. That's where
so I wouldn't know if
from.
The guys at Hill and Knowlton wrote that.
Is that not unbelievable?
It's God love her. She can say it with a straight face.
Yeah, well, she sure can, and
that's why you get the kickbacks for saying it with a straight face.
That's why you get the big bucks, right? But let's uh-huh. so you've got so now we've got two potential villains. This is the multiple choice test. Okay. A, it's retail crime gangs. B, it's you, the splurging technology consumer. But we have a third potential villain. This comes courtesy of Mervyn King. He's the former head of the Bank of England. Let's listen to who he says is responsible for inflation. Okay, let's just take a look at this.
In March 2020, people argued, well, there's some disruption in financial markets. We better intervene and print money to prevent a collapse of certain financial markets. But that went away within a matter of weeks. And at that point, you would have expected central banks to withdraw the support that they were giving. Rather than withdrawing it, they doubled down and did a lot more. And I think if you just print a great deal of money, it was most extreme in the United States, where the Federal Reserve printed money at a rate that was faster than at any point since the Second World War.
After COVID?
After COVID started, 2020, 2021. You know, their money supply, held by businesses and households, was growing at 25% a year. Now, you don't have to believe in a mechanical link between that and inflation, but you should be asking yourself the question, what do we think is going on here? You know, if we keep printing money at this rate, what will happen? And the answer is obvious. You'll get inflation.
Holy shit. We've had fairy tale deflation for the first time this entire episode.
So
Mervyn King tells the truth. It's the Fed.
Well, Mervyn King has a habit of telling the truth, particularly after he left the Bank of England.
Now that he's not in the Bank of England, he's, he's happy to tell the truth.
So he, after he left, he wrote a book trying to come up with real solutions. He didn't go all the way, but he did try to do his bit within the framework he's in. But, it's so funny because it's so obvious that this is what happened.
I know.
I don't know when if you can pull up the SPACs chart that we, do you have the SPACs chart that I sent?
Yeah, I do. Where is that? Let me. I'm going to move it up with another chart we were going to look at, global wages. Let's take a look at global wages.
Then we'll go to inflation.
Okay, we'll go from global wages. Here we go. Global wages take a hit as inflation eats into paychecks. So there you go.
Wow. That's pain.
Right here.
Yeah, and you're
real money. Yeah. Your paycheck. There it is.
Yeah, and the pain in the countries that are in the dollar bear trap is much, much worse than that.
Yeah, great point. Yeah.
I sent you, somebody did a map of the world with inflation rates.
Let's go to SPACs, though, to finish this off. Okay. There's global wages. Now let's look at SPACs. Here you go.
Right. So we just published the SPAC study that showed the explosion of SPACs during the 2020 and 2021. And this is a phenomenon. So a SPAC is a special acquisition corporation. It's a blind pool. And that just doesn't happen. And so this was a huge anomaly, and that's why we did a study. And I think it proves, what we wrote proves beyond any shadow of a doubt that the whole thing was an op. Anyway, but of course, when you print in the way that Mervyn King is talking about, you can have this phenomena where not only do you have a huge increase in initial public offerings in the stock market, but a large percentage of them are blind pools. I mean, it's just it's such a bubble phenomenon, you don't know what to say.
Right. But, and note that this cannot be explained away with retail crime gangs or splurging or splurging technology consumers. This is Fed. Okay. This is Fed money doing this, not retail crime gangs.
Right, because you're talking about a tsunami of central bank money. But here's what's interesting. Look at 2020, party over. I sent somebody this chart. I think I sent you this chart and I said, party over.
Well, that's a graph of the Fed's balance sheet.
Right.
You're looking at it. Exactly. It's a bar graph of the Fed's balance sheet.
But look at the drop in activity this year.
Well, that's because the Fed stopped expanding its balance sheet this year.
Right. Exactly. Right?
It started contracting its balance sheet. The balance sheet peaked this year.
Right.
And then it started going down. Anyway. Right. There's one more, I think, in this
Yeah, it's just the proceeds. It says the proceeds, same thing.
Basically the same chart.
Same chart.
Yeah, it's the same chart. Yeah. Okay, let's keep it going. We got BIS. We had deodorant on the last story. let's go to handguns in FedWatch. Other forms of control. Number of handgun owners carrying daily nearly doubles in the U.S. A new study published in the American Journal of Public Health, interesting, revealed the number of law-abiding Americans carrying a loaded handgun daily nearly doubled between 2015 and 2019, from 9 million to 16 million. Yeah. There was no explanation by the study's authors for the rapid increase in daily handgun carrying adults. But during the period, social unrest in Ferguson, Missouri, and Baltimore City, Maryland, as well as surging violent crime across certain metro areas, could be the reason behind the trend. This is before, by the way,
right?
2015, 2019. This is before pandemic was rolled out. But that's right. That's an interesting. So you can only imagine that number's going up.
You know, every time I talk to anybody in the United States, that number is just people who could never fathom why I own guns and why I wanted to be trained with a gun. You know, they would be very critical. Gun ownership was considered to be something, you know, wholly unnecessary. Now, you know, they keep coming back and saying, oh, now I understand. And I think I'm going to get trained and carry a gun. So,
yeah, right. Doesn't seem so unreasonable now, does it?
No, it doesn't. And here's what was interesting. Traditionally, people who were for gun control didn't understand the connection between owning a gun and being allowed to protect property rights as a political matter. And I think now they're beginning to see, you know, if we don't have a gun, look at what could happen.
Yeah, right. Okay, let's go to last story in FedWatch. Comes courtesy of Carl Denninger. A warning which we will ignore. This concerns the power outage in Moore County, the criminal occurrence. Moore County being where Pinehurst is in North Carolina. Two substations were taken out with what is presumed to be small arms rifle fire from obviously what were a very small group of people, perhaps one or two at each location. But he asked, why couldn't this be fixed immediately? Answer, they don't have spare parts for the stuff that was damaged at the substation. And he goes on and says, this sort of disruption is tiny compared to what 100 dedicated men, you know, could do anytime they decided to. Further, while I'm sure they'll find parts somewhere in the U.S. and restore power, if the damage was to continue to 50 counties instead of one, you know, you'd have a real problem on your hands. And that's a point well taken. And I'm told on good authority, from one of your subscribers, actually, this morning, says, you know, an earlier similar incident occurred in Beaufort County, and people down there, nobody is believing the official story about this.
I don't believe the official story. Now, one thing, they've imposed the equivalent of martial law by putting I forget what the hours are, but basically, you're under lockdown at night. Now, this is right next to Southern Pines as well, which is where a lot of special forces and training go on. And it's contiguous. Fort Bragg is in the next county, but has some operations in this county. So one of my questions is, did they just want to keep everybody locked down at night so they could move stuff in and out?
Great question.
I mean, you know, we're back to adult fairy tales. The official narrative is a fairy tale, and then the question is, you're left guessing what's going on. But if I were in Moore County and I was basically put under martial law without declaring martial law, I'd be furious. There's no reason. I mean, anybody in the South is prepared to go a couple days without electricity. We all know this can happen. And why you need to lock people in at night because of it makes no sense.
Right. Yeah.
Something stinks.
It does. It does. There's more incidents that have gone on in North Carolina just that one, including one, you know, near Raleigh, but you know.
Well, I love what Carl said because the supply lines and the inventory of parts for so many different functions are way too thin.
Yeah.
way right. too thin, and it's really dangerous.
Very dangerous. Right. Yeah. Okay. Let's turn to crypto. Interesting stuff going on in crypto space, including the narrative. You know, again, more fairy tale inflation. Let's just go to this first story. Crypto lender BlockFi filing for bankruptcy and conducting major layoffs as FTX contagion. They keep punching the pump in this notion. There's this contagion, claims another source. So they're trying to make it sound like the 2008 financial crisis, right? Oh, it's contagion. Right. You know, everybody affects everybody. But if you look into the story, you get the nuts and bolts of it. BlockFi, which let users earn yield for depositing idle cryptocurrencies on the platform, first halted withdrawals on November 11th, the very same day FTX filed for bankruptcy. Why? Because in June, it got a $250 million line of credit with FTX, roughly a week after the crypto lender cut staff by roughly 20%. So in other words, BlockFi was in trouble and it got a lifeline from FTX. And it said it was reducing headcount to reduce due to the dramatic shift in macroeconomic conditions. BlockFi isn't the only platform that FTX bailed out, okay? FTX is a busy beaver bailing out all these companies and then goes boom. The crypto exchange also doled out a $120 million loan in August 2021 to the Liquid Group after the latter suffered a $90 million hack. So you can see hack and contagion. Liquid was then acquired by FTX in May of 2022. So you see all these things. It's not really contagion. It's really BlockFi. It's really tumbling dominoes from one criminal actor.
Right, but you're pulling the plug. You've been running a series of bubbles, and now you're pulling the plug on them.
Yeah,
that's what it is.
Right, right. It's plug pulling.
Right,
right.
Well, that's anyway. To a certain extent. That's what happened in the financial crisis. It was just this plug is within the crypto world. The plug they did, you know, they pulled the plug on the housing bubble. Because they had been keeping it going with massive fraud for years. And then Goldman shorted and pulled the plug. I knew they were going to do it because they wanted to settle our litigation at the beginning of December. We settled at the beginning of 2006. And when they came and the change in their negotiating position, I remember saying to Carolyn, they're going to pull the plug on the housing market. They're finally going to do it.
Yeah, but if you look back at 2008, the number of players and the magnitude of what we're talking about, the derivatives back then in notional value were 1.2 quadrillion.
Right.
You just saw the numbers there. It was like 250 million.
Right. The ultimate taxpayer bailout was 27 trillion. So, you know, the entire crypto market is right now, what is it? It's not even a half a trillion.
Yeah, I don't think so.
Right. So if you look at the size of the market and the size right. of the fraud, this doesn't touch the financial crisis.
It's not even the same ballpark.
Right.
It's not the same zip code. Yeah.
Right. Right.
Okay, but let's keep it going. Next story, interesting too. Rising Tether loans add risk to stablecoin crypto world. This is interesting. The first thing that's interesting about this story is I had not seen this guy's name, Jonathan Weil, in a long time. I was like totally forgot about it. He wrote a lot of great stories in the financial crisis.
Yes,
and
he
then
did.
Kind of vanished. I don't remember seeing this guy's name in the last.
I thought was he at the Wall Street Journal or at Bloomberg? I thought he was at Bloomberg.
He was at Bloomberg, right? Yeah. Exactly. And now you see his name again, and he's writing for the Journal.
Right.
That was the first thing. Like,
yeah, during the financial crisis, he did a lot of good work.
He wrote some dynamite stories. I remember, like, okay, this is the guy. This is one of the only guys in the mainstream media I could trust. It was Jonathan Weil, and it was the guy who filed the FOIA request.
Right.
Also at Bloomberg, Mark Pittman.
Right.
Mark Pittman, who sues the Fed on FOIA and wins and then dies. But but Weil was in on, he was kind of, they were, those were two guys I could count on.
Right.
And then he vanishes and now he comes back. Okay.
Well, let's go back to this. When Pittman died, he probably wanted to take a break.
Yeah. Maybe I'll take a decade-long breather.
Yeah.
Okay. But now he's back, okay? And he's back in the crypto space.
Go over to the Art Beat or the local finance.
Yeah. The company behind the Tether stablecoin has increasingly been lending its own coins to customers rather than selling them for hard currency up front. The shift adds to risk that the company may not have enough liquid assets to pay redemptions in a crisis. These loans have appeared for several quarters in the financial reports, which are unaudited, but they appear in the company's financial reports that Tether shows on its website. For the most recent report, they reached $6.1 billion as of the third quarter, or 9% of the company's total assets. So, yeah, okay, 9% is a big but not a huge number. Stablecoins such as Tether are anchors in the system. They are vital for trading many cryptocurrencies and are widely held by traders. The premise of Tether, as well as other stablecoins, is that the issuer will always redeem one coin for $1. Issuers take pains to demonstrate that they have ample funds available to do so. So what was the problem with Tether? Tether took Tether took the unusual step of discussing a borrower's identity with respect to crypto, with respect to Celsius network, which collapsed in July. Tether at that time said Celsius position has been liquidated with no losses to Tether. In other words, it had lent Tether, it lent Celsius money, and Celsius goes down. Some collateral held by Tether, in other words, like collateral from Celsius, included Bitcoin, right? Mm-hmm. That collateral could be worth less than it was when the loans were made. Celsius used Bitcoin as collateral for its loans from Tether, according to Tether's statement at the time. And here you come to the nub. The problem with using Bitcoin as collateral, Bitcoin fell 63% this year. Tether doesn't say what the loan's market value is or whether the collateral includes cryptocurrencies. But Tether, you know, they got out alive because they took on enough collateral and the drop wasn't big enough. But there in that story, you sort of see the danger of crypto companies lending to each other in cryptocurrencies that are tied to the dollar.
Here's the other thing. If Tether is critical to going in and out of Bitcoin in terms of market share, what's that going to do to Bitcoin?
Don't know.
Right. That's the question.
That's the question. Yeah.
Whenever I read a description of Tether's reporting and disclosure and, you know, and the check and balances of audits and regulations, it's not anything I would ever trust.
Yeah. Well, it is and it isn't. And we'll see that kind of in the next story, which let's just cut to it. If I'm a Bitcoin owner and I see this next story, I'd be furious.
Right.
You know, it's hard to avoid the feeling that Bitcoin is under attack. You know, I'm not a fan.
It's absolutely under attack.
This next story, I'd be livid.
This is a really sleazy cheap shot.
This is so sleazy. It's ridiculous.
Right. Right.
This is from European Insider, this business insider over in Europe. Bitcoin is on the road to irrelevance. Note the quote marks. And its last gasp was already on the horizon before FTX's collapse, ECB officials say. What the hell are ECB officials doing wading into this space? Okay.
So if you look at the date.
Yeah,
check out the date.
It's November 30th.
Right. So it's 2 weeks, you know, it's 20 days after FTX files. You know, so they decide to run a hit on Bitcoin.
Yeah.
It's a hit. A
big time hit. Yeah. Total hit. So let's get into the hit. Let me just cut back to it here. Here's a quote. For Bitcoin proponents, the seeming stabilization signals a breather on the way to new heights, wrote Ulrich Bintzel and Jürgen Schaaf, who both serve in the ECB's Market Infrastructure and Payments Division. More likely, however, get this, it is an artificially induced last gasp before the road to irrelevance, and this was already foreseeable before FTX went bust and sent Bitcoin price to well below $1,600. These guys are unbelievable, come out saying stuff like that.
Well, it gets followed up by the BIS. The BIS comes out with a study and somehow miraculously has access to the databases of a huge number of exchanges.
Yeah, right.
And what they document with their study of the exchange data is that people buy Bitcoin when the price is going up. And the reason they buy it is not for all the many reasons given. They buy it because they want to make money. And what they claim from this data is the majority bought over 20,000. So now they estimate essentially 3/4 of Bitcoin buyers have lost money.
Right.
Right. And you follow the ECB up with that hit from the BIS. And it's like, you know, it's a pow pow. Right?
Yeah. Right.
So they're running ahead on Bitcoin. Right. And here's the interesting thing. If they go after Tether, they can do huge damage to Bitcoin.
I think that's going to happen. I think that's coming.
Right.
I almost certainly. They're not going to give up. The notion right. that the central banks are going to use a stable coin as a global settlement currency is just, that's a fantasy. That's a fantasy of someone who's in their basement and they're just disconnected to reality.
Well, my expectation is they're going to try and use Ripple in very important ways. And so one of our teams sent you a copy of the Ripple versus SEC lawsuit. Yeah. And I was looking, I was thinking, oh, great, the bad guys against the bad guys. We can have fun with this.
That'll be interesting to watch that docket.
Yeah.
Okay, let's keep it going. Let's turn to Farmageddon.
Okay.
For crypto. Okay, this first story from Shabnam. I believe I know Shabnam from her earlier presentation. But she writes here, why are half of the WHO's senior leadership leaving? This is one of the stories I couldn't highlight. But you can get it right here in the first two paragraphs. Half of the WHO's 16-member senior leadership team at the Geneva headquarters will leave the global body at the end of November, including the chief scientist and assistant director general for access to medicines and health products. The announcement of the departure of the eight senior leaders, was made in a short email to staff by Director General Tedros on Tuesday, thanking the leadership for their service. And that's really it. That's the hard information there. Half of the senior leadership's leaving.
So the WHO right now has been negotiating a secret treaty. And with all their members behind closed doors, no disclosure. There have been some leaks, but a secret treaty by which they do a global vaccine passport, i.e. complete digital control, is what they're pushing for. And the ability for the WHO to announce a pandemic, whether it's true or not, and suddenly everybody's got to go along with it, including if you're in the United States, your state health officer. So they're basically putting into place a global dictatorship, you know, through virus and infectious disease fraud is really what it is. And I just think you've got eight people. I don't know if they got fired or if they quit. But you've got a certain number of people there who are not excited about implementing, you know, global genocide.
Right. They weren't going along with the program for one reason or another.
Right.
Right.
They weren't enthusiastic about.
Yeah.
You know, about.
Yeah, they weren't enthusiastic
criminal
enough.
They weren't sufficiently enthusiastic about criminal enterprise.
Right. They weren't.
They had signed on board for criminal enterprise, right?
We need you, Tedros. We need you all in, okay?
Right.
You guys aren't all in. You got to go.
Okay. So I told you. Do you remember the Victor the Cleaner story?
Hmm.
Okay. So there's a great scene in La Femme Nikita where a covert operation goes wrong, and they have to send.
Yeah, they bring in the cleaner.
They bring in the cleaner, right. And Harvey Keitel. Yeah, he's such a great cleaner, and. The goal is to be sufficiently obsequious to the cleaner that he doesn't kill you, right?
Yeah, right.
And I call it turbo chipper. You got to really be turbo chipper. And I would say those eight people, whatever they were, they weren't pleasing the cleaner.
Right.
Right.
Right. Right. So they got liquidated.
Yeah, exactly. If I were them, I would watch my back. I would watch my back. Really?
Yeah. Yeah. I'm glad that's not my problem. I'm going to leave it at that. Okay, next story on mass formation. We come back to it. COVID-19 mass formation or mass atrocity. And it concerns Matthias Desmet's book, The Psychology of Totalitarianism. And this is a long piece, but they point out some really interesting things here about Desmet. Let's go down. He's rather than trace the illusions of COVID-19 and of the illusions being the gaslighting, the false information, the propaganda, rather than trace the illusions of COVID-19 to the powerful entities and actors who have dictated and enforced the science with a trademark from the very beginning, The Psychology of Totalitarianism, Desmond Spooks, maintains that populations have primarily their own neuroses and auto-oppressive impulses to blame. They blame themselves. While Desmond acknowledges, for example, that Klaus Schwab's Great Reset book and pandemic planning exercises by the Rockefeller Foundation, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, and Johns Hopkins University described how society would go into lockdown as a result of the pandemic, that a biopassport would be introduced, that people would be tracked and traced with subcutaneous sensors, and so on, Desmond argues that any such consistency among these totalitarians occurs because populations perpetually push their leaders, like Klaus, in a totalitarian direction. That is unbelievable.
Well, here's what's interesting, because this gets into the whole issue of weaponizing mental health. What the debate was about, mass atrocity versus mass formation, is if you have a mass atrocity, which we have had, and I would say is ongoing, so we're in the middle of a mass atrocity, you know, millions of people have been killed, disabled, lost their jobs, had their economics destroyed. So you have millions of people who've been killed or seriously harmed. And the question is, are we going to apply the rule of law? Are we going to hold accountable the people who did that? You know, because what we're looking at are multiple crimes. And not only are we looking at multiple crimes, but we're looking at multiple crimes by institutions who have a long history of multiple crimes. So we're watching serial felons. And the question is, you know, I go back to my expression, crime that pays is crime that stays. You know, you've got to have the rule of law. If you don't have the rule of law, as you have told us many times, you have the rule of man. And then you're in a completely different world than we've ever known in the Western world. And the people who engineer mass atrocity get out of jail free card. Oh, I know I killed millions of people, but it was all, I was part of a mass hysteria. I didn't do anything to stop the killing that was going on, but it's okay because I was part of a mass hysteria. And you, John Titus, are trying to hold people accountable to law, and you're so upset about it. It's because you're part of a mass hysteria, and we need to put you in a mental institute.
So
it's very clever because it can work to protect the perpetrators. Right. It can work to protect the people who went along with the perpetrators, and it can be used to incarcerate or, you know, marginalize the people who are trying to argue for the rule of law. It's quite, yeah. I mean, what they're up to is very clever.
Yeah, it is.
Right.
It's very clever, and it's working, but sadly.
I don't think it's working. I don't think it's working. And one reason I'm so pleased with this article is I think for people to understand what the game that is afoot to basically give the perpetrators a get out of jail free card, you know, they need to understand exactly the two sides, you know, what mass atrocity and accountability looks like in the rule of law versus the game that's being played with mass formation. And this article is long and very detailed, but it lays it all out. And I think a lot of people need to see it at that complexity level to really understand.
Yeah. You bring up mental health, which is, you know, the weaponization of mental health. And that takes us to our next, you know, the final segment of Pharmageddon. And this is Dr. Peter Bragan who talks about this very issue.
Right.
I'm going to play a clip here just by way of background. Bragan has described right before this clip the use of mental health as a weapon, both historically and in other countries, namely Germany, China, and Russia. And then he says this.
In the U.S., we are aware of a school teacher who, under New York state law, when she refused to cooperate with masking and she didn't believe in the vaccines, under New York state law, we're practically totalitarians here now, we're certainly authoritarians. She was sent for psychiatric evaluation, and the excerpts which I've been provided that he used, that the school board used, diagnosed her as psychotic on the basis of her belief that there are evil forces in the universe behind all this.
Right.
Hello. Now, unfortunately, I might have thought it was, I would never use psychiatry that way. But 3 years ago, I might have thought that was certainly way out. I don't think it's way out at all now. I think it's the truth.
Yeah.
Yep.
There you go. It's the truth.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
And Peter has been the most vocal about criticizing the use of mass formation, and Dr. Robert Malone has just sued him for $25 million.
Yeah.
And I'll talk about that on Ask Catherine this week, so we don't need to talk about it here, but that's a lot of firepower trying to protect the ability to create a get out of jail free card for
sure is. Yep.
Yep.
Sure is.
Yep. Yep.
Okay, let's go to pushback. We'll see how this first one, you know, lands, whether it works, but it's a good sign. GOP senators say they will block military funding unless vaccine mandate is scrapped. Republicans in the Senate have threatened to block the National Defense Authorization Act unless a vote is held on the current COVID vaccine mandate for military personnel. And that's really it. They're talking about, you know, you got to get rid of this mandate or that thing's not going
Here's
through.
The
we'll
thing,
see whether
the whole,
that sticks.
The whole military is dependent on the southern states for their troops.
Yeah.
And those southern states are Christian and they all want religious exemptions because they're not going to take the mark of the beast.
Yeah.
That's pretty simple. Yeah.
Yeah. We'll see how that works out, though.
This is all I can tell you is the whole process of what's going on in the military is gruesome and it's going to get more gruesome.
Yeah.
This is part of it.
I'm not going to stake my emotional health on the positive outcome of that.
No.
Okay. So let's keep it going and push back. Consumer Group warns 10 states with most pension dollars invested in China-connected BlackRock. So the angle here is on China, but, you know, good for them on targeting BlackRock. The letter from this consumer group, we urge elected officials to do their due diligence in educating themselves and their staff on the multiple risks posed by BlackRock's extensive investments in Chinese companies, both from an ethical standpoint as well as a fiduciary responsibility owed to pension U.S. pension holders and retirees, William Hild, executive director of the Consumer Research, said in a letter to the 10 governors. And then they list the states. Washington State invests $13 billion of state pension funds into BlackRock, according to this research, followed by Florida with $10 billion. And then they got New York and so on down. But that's basically that story there, is they're you know, upset about China. But note that they said, you're not upholding your fiduciary obligation to investors, you know, to your pension holders.
Right.
And that really goes to the next story. And this one's out of Florida. Florida pulls $2 billion from BlackRock in largest anti-ESG divestment. So their angle is different. But Florida's chief investment officer said on Thursday his department would pull $2 billion worth of its assets managed by BlackRock, the biggest such divestment by a state opposed to the asset manager's environmental, social, and corporate governance ESG policies. And then he says down here you go. Florida's Treasury Division is divesting from BlackRock because they have openly stated they've got other goals than producing returns. That's the nub of the issue to me, is, you know, your job is to make money.
Right.
What is this ESG nonsense? What are you doing? So you started to get pushback, and that's a good thing.
So here's the challenge. The pension funds have for decades paid attention to things other than just making money, because, you know, they're if a company doesn't attend to long-term quality of governance and other issues, then it's going to crash and burn eventually. So there's an issue of, are we here to generate short-term returns or long-term returns? The problem with the ESG that BlackRock is implementing is it has nothing to do with any of that. It has nothing to do with those qualitative features that turn into long-term gains. So it's none of the short-term, long-term thing. It's basically doing to the company what Disney did to, you know, itself. It's saying, we don't care about what the customers want. We don't care what the shareholders want. We have a political agenda, and we're here to implement and use this company and its resources to implement our agenda, which has nothing to do with fiduciary obligation under the an obligation to shareholders.
Right, so, which is in the cover story changes from one week to the next. One day it's global warming, the next day it's global cooling.
Right.
You know, so there's no consistency whatever. It's completely arbitrary and capricious. It's just their political whim. That's it.
It's worse than that. I mean, it's a centralization of control, which is destructive to the economy and to the environment and to people. I could talk a lot about this because I've spent a lot of time trying to understand ESG and what they're really up to, you know. But if you look at the real agenda behind it, it's so ugly and evil. It's central control. It's slavery.
Yeah. Well, to me, it's like, well, once you're untethered from making me money, we're done. I don't give it. I'm not going to invest any more time listening to your stupid effing excuse. Okay.
Right.
Forget it. You make me money or get out. Get out.
Right.
And that's what Florida's saying. And that's good.
Well, but here's the thing. If your only goal is to make money, then we all ought to just steal drugs. Do you know what I mean? In other words,
they have to make money. It's lawful. They have, you know, they're going to get, they have to abide by the law in making money.
Pfizer can say, you know, I'm making money, you know, and I would never put it. I mean, I was raised to never finance your enemy. So I would put a dime in Pfizer. I don't care how much money they're making.
In an honest and open fact-finding environment, I would agree with that, but we don't have that.
Right, right. Well, anyway, ESG is toxic, and it's politically toxic. It's financially toxic. So now, you notice Florida
But the ESG, as long as it's a way for making money, it could be ESG today, and it'll be something else tomorrow.
Right, right.
Another hobgoblin.
But you notice Florida left $8 billion in.
Yeah, I think that's right. Yeah.
Right. So they took $2 billion out, but they left $8 billion in. But let's see what the other states do, because, you know, nothing would be better than the other states start to do the same.
Yeah. Yeah. Right, that would be great. And good, it's getting coverage too, you know.
Right.
Okay. Last story in Pushback. This is from Japan. This is a professor emeritus. From I think Kyoto University, which I have to think Kyoto.
Oh, this is a good rant. Yeah,
this is Kyoto's that's a nice town. I've actually been there. I haven't traveled that much, but I have been to Kyoto. It's nice.
And I want to say one thing. He mentions the pathology reports. One of the things I've seen happen in the medical community is when they get in and they do autopsies and they see what's going on in the pathology reports. It's shocking and very clear.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. This guy's name is Dr. Masanori Fukushima, and he is addressing here the Japanese Ministry of Health. I'm just going to kind of let this run because I just love this guy's intensity.
何やってんだってことだ。隠蔽したくて、しょうがないんですよ、この事実を。かって薬害がそうだった。母さん、ものすごくそれで苦しんだわけじゃない。ね、だから何としても薬害を根絶しないといけない。この国は薬害からレッスンを受けて、もう二度と薬害ができない国になってるんです。だけど、それを強引に無視して、何兆円も使ってこのワクチンをワクチン輸入して、国民に先導して、だからちっとも収まらないんです。 私、昨年このワクチンが普及すると困ると思って、このワクチンによってパンデミックが解決すると思うのは妄想であると断じましたよ。専門雑誌の中で。これはもうミスコンセプションで、今ようやくこのことが分かってきた。メッセンジャーRNAをナノパーティクルに、ナノパーティクルに来るんで入れることがいかに危険かということだ。あらゆる細胞がそれを飲み込んで、それで細胞が変換してっちゃうんですよ。そういうことがもう今分かったんだよね。 メカニズムがはっきりしてる。即刻評価委員解散して前例調査しなさい。これが結論だね。前例調査だよ。だからワクチン打ってから調子が悪くなった人はみんな医療機関に周知して、ね、もたもたしてちゃダメです。何が起こるかわかんない。神経血管障害、自己免疫疾患、感染しやすい。それから脳にも来るんだ。ナノパーティクルは脳に取り込まれるんです。これを頭の悪い学者は血液関門が通らないから大丈夫だって。バカじゃないって言いたい。 自然免疫が抑えられるんです。だから日本人が初めね、蔓延しなかったのは唾液中に IgA があって、コロナには対して交差耐性があるから抑えられてたんですよ。ところがワクチン打ったがためにそれがシャットダウンされた。自然免疫が抑えられたからこういうことになってるんですよ。ちっとも収まらないじゃない。ね。どんどん広がりますよ。今、ブレイクスルー感染、計算しました？もう、ほとんどの人がブレイクスルー感染ですよ。今、 かかってる人がね、ワクチン打ってない人がかかってるんじゃないの。ワクチン打った人が移し合ってる。厚労省から提示されてるデータで全部明らかだから、あとお話ししますよ、ね。データ全部おし、あの。
Wow. I mean, one of the reasons I was in Kyoto is I represented one of the seven Mitsubishi sister companies. I never saw anyone speak like that. They're very careful.
They're very careful.
Yeah,
gracious.
Stayed.
Right.
Yep.
So we're just about next week for the Hero of the Week next week to publish a rant by an Australian senator, which is the best rant I've seen yet from a legislator globally. Incredible.
Really?
Yeah, I sent it to you. I don't know if you saw it.
No, I haven't seen it. Yeah, I haven't watched it yet.
I'll send it to you so you can see it before next. It is the best rant ever.
So, yeah, I'll explain why I haven't seen it in a minute. But now let's turn to charts. You ready?
Okay, let's go.
Okay, here we go. Dollar. What do we got? Down.
Yeah, so the dollar's backed off. It's down to 105.
Yeah.
So the bear trap is not as painful as it was when it was headed up to 114. And we'll see in a chart in a minute that interest rates coming down with it. And we've got a Fed meeting next week. And I'm sure, you know, when Powell talks to Carson's on his hour phone every month, Carson's will feel better that the bear trap is not as painful as it was. It's still painful. Yeah. It's still, look at where it's come this year. It's still up a lot.
Right. It's
year.
Still way up. I mean, from 95 to 105, that's a 10% increase. That's a lot in a year. For a currency as huge as the dollar.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. It's a big move.
Big
anyway,
move.
So
okay.
It's retracing it. Go ahead.
Here's your bond. Here's your interest rate.
Yeah. So this is the 10-year treasury and it's coming. It's off a little bit. And Powell had said recently that at the next meeting, which is next week, they're only going to bump it 50 basis points. So we'll see what happens.
Okay. Famous last words.
Right.
Here we go. Gold, silver, S&P.
Yeah, so we're coming into the end of the year, and as you can see, no asset classes have done really well, except maybe the oil stocks. But S&P now down 17.5%. Gold and silver doing better, but still down so far for the year.
Yeah, this reminds me of a mini 2008 when the S&P 500 was down by 37.5. And gold and silver were up by about, you know, between 5 and 10.
Right.
So it's sort of a compressed version of what happened in 2008 this year. Interesting.
Right. And we've had a couple investment banks come out and predict really ugly year next year. So,
yeah.
You know, the fears of deflation are upon us. There's no doubt.
Yeah.
That doesn't mean it's going to happen, but... You know, I would say there are more and more people worried about another big down next year.
I think that's right. Yeah. A lot of people worried about that. Okay. Here we're done with graphs. And that's
okay.
I've been working on, I'm doing a presentation for this, which is why I haven't really looked at anything you've sent in the last day or so.
Well, I appreciate you doing it. They were adamant. You have to get John Titus. Annual wrap-up was very popular with the, you know, with that crowd. So we have a Doctors for COVID Ethics Symposium. It'll be live streamed this Saturday night.
Yeah.
So it'll start 5 p.m. Europe and 11 a.m. Eastern at UK Column and CHDTV. It'll stream. And this one is called Light from Darkness. They'll go into the real dangers of the mRNA injections, not just COVID, but all of them, because it's a huge pipeline and growing. And then it will go into the control grid, how we stop the control grid, and great presentations from a variety of people, including Patrick Wood, Corey Lynn, yourself, obviously all the doctors, and then Sasha Ladipova, and Meryl Nass talking about the use of emergency youth authorization in military, and two of the authors on the mass atrocity versus mass formation article. So it's an incredible lineup, and we'll live stream it on Saturday, but then, you know, UK Column sometime the next week, we'll get all the videos up so they'll all be available. Anyway, I recommend it. Obviously free, open, available to everybody.
Yeah. Okay. All right, let's keep it going. Holiday greetings.
Yeah. So we have, if you go there now to holidaygreetings.solaria.com, our 2022 greeting is up. It wasn't there when you took that snapshot, but it's up now. So it's holidaygreetings.salier.com. You can see our holiday greetings and all the great things we're have in store for you over Christmas, as well as our Christmas donations. And we did a whole series of Christmas donations. I won't go through all of them, but take a look. And if you have the capacity to give, I would encourage you to give to those groups or others like them in your life, in your community. A lot of money we spent on the new media. And we had a wonderful donor who gave us a big check and right after Thanksgiving, and that's what we use to do our Christmas donations.
Okay, great. And blast from the past?
So I love this one. Harry Blaser and I did an interview in 2017 on the culinary history of Christmas, and I was suspicious that Harry wouldn't prepare, so I got three books on the culinary traditions of Christmas, read them, and learned so much that was absolutely fascinating about why we eat what we eat on Christmas. Anyway, this was Harry and I up in Montana in the middle of a snowstorm, sort of recording it. And it includes a shorty on the history of the candy cane, which to me is one of the great Christmas food stories. Anyway, but...
the candy cane, yeah.
Oh, well, you know, it was invented. Candy cane was first created by the guy who ran the Cologne Cathedral in Cologne, Germany. And he did it to keep the kids quiet during the Christmas ceremony.
Yeah. See, you know, this is like ESG. I don't all that. That's nice. I eat that stuff because it's made out of sugar and it tastes good.
Well, that's why he did. He gave the kids sugar to keep them quiet, right? Nothing's changed.
Right. That's a good way to shut me up. Okay. Let's keep it going. Best of Salieri. All right.
So during December, every week we have the best of Salieri, and the first week last week was the weekly interviews. So check out the best of Salieri. We want to make sure as we end the year, that you just get our picks for the best things we had available. And if you haven't had time to check them out or listen to them, this gives you another chance to see them and get the best of the Salieri report for the last year. We could see one of these was Dr. Skidmore's, the COVID-19 survey, which was one of the, to me, the great accomplishments of this year. It was the first time I was sure I understood what was happening with the COVID-19 injections and the incredible damage they were doing. It was a very fearless thing he did and really valuable.
Okay. Speaking of damage, here we go. Template for insurance. Letter.
So we are in the process of writing a series of letters that you can use. This is the same idea as the COVID-19 form to help you represent yourself. Because we've seen life insurance companies in real trouble because of the rise in all-cause mortality, this is a letter you can use to write or communicate with your insurance broker about your life insurance policy and whether you need to worry about the creditworthiness of the insurance company that issued it. So this is designed to help you grapple with this and understand what the credit issues are, if any, before they really impact you. So it's a way of sort of making sure you understand what the risk is of as all-cause mortality increases impact your insurance company and therefore your life insurance policy.
Yeah, I love that. Advocate for yourself. You're doing that. That I think that's a magnificent service.
Yep.
Okay. Let's, last thing, we've got a book review.
Yep. So Michael Schumann for decades now has been focused as an attorney and entrepreneur and held to help people invest locally. And he, you know, he's been at it for a long time. He's worked very hard. He's learned a lot and he understands how risky and tricky investing can be. So this is not just, you know, hoopla. This is somebody who really knows the issues. It's targeted at people from the United States. So if you're outside of the United States, it's probably not for you. But if you are interested in doing more local investment, this is a good primer to help you sort of think about it and get going. So I didn't write the review until Carolyn Betts had taken one of his workshops and came back and said, you know, these are good. Go ahead. So if you're interested in local investment, Schumann's website, his workshops, and his book are one way to get you going.
Okay.
Okay.
Super. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Fairy tales, John.
Fairy tale inflation. God, it's not over.
Krugman came out, Paul Krugman, the economist, came out and he said 3% inflation, you know, he implied that 3% inflation is enough to inflate away the debt problem. Because we're seeing lots of stories now about the U.S. debt and the fact that the debt is skyrocketing.
Yeah.
And there was a big debate, you know, and the idea was it's going to take 11% inflation or higher to deal with the debt. Depends on where the debt goes.
Wow.
I would think it would be higher than 11%, but let's
I think that's realistically it's going to be higher, yeah.
I mean, remember, Argentina is right now at 88%, so I'm not saying we'll get to Argentina, but it seems to me that the getting that 11% number down to 3%, that's a big fairy tale.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. Another big fairy tale. Right. Yeah. The wow is because... some semi-official organ like Krugman would even acknowledge 11%.
I don't know. You know, I think Krugman is always going to make Victor the cleaner happy.
Yeah, right, right, right. Yeah, good point.
Very, okay,
very,
John.
Very good point. We have the annual, because I'm putting together the spreadsheet of stories. I just want to say I'm putting, cobbling together the stories of the year, and there's it's interesting. It's going to be interesting.
So what John's referring to is the fact that we never do money in markets at the last week of the year.
Right.
Until this month. We are going to do money in markets on the last week of the month. And and that's thanks to you. And you're, you know, what we discussed is we're going to come up with what we think are the most important stories for money in markets for the year.
They're interesting. Yeah.
Yeah.
And I'm only about maybe a third of the way through. I'm still... I got sidetracked with Doctor for COVID Ethics, but I'll get back onto it. It's interesting. That's going to be an interesting episode.
So one of the things you said was that FTX is probably going to be the story of the year. Do you still think that?
I think the story of the year probably is still Russia. But FTX, we don't know enough to say this year whether FTX will be the story because that story is still writing itself. I check the docket every day on the bankruptcy in Delaware.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I have a Pacer account. I go in and look at the docket entries. It's, I don't want to say it's slow moving, but it's slow enough moving. It's not going to resolve itself in terms of its importance. It's not going to reveal itself anytime this year.
Right.
So we don't know.
So if Bankman-Fried is being invited to speak with Yellen, if you look at the fraud going on in the Treasury and the fraud going on in the crypto world,
Something's up. That story is going to be very important for purposes of narrative in the future. No doubt about that. But it may be until 2023 where we say, how could we have missed that story? That's hands down the most important story.
So what we should do is when we do the last money markets, we should come up with the three best adult fairy tales.
Oh.
Or how about the three most outrageous?
That's a tall order.
Yeah.
There's some big ones, though. Yeah. We covered some big ones this year. I will tell you that. Like, oh, I forgot about that. That's ridiculous. Yeah.
Okay. I'm going to think on that. The three most outrageous fairy tales and the three most outrageous.
I promise you'll have a lot to choose from.
Okay, well, we're keeping our state of amusement, John. Thank you. I will talk to you next week. And ladies and gentlemen, thank you for joining us for Money and Markets.
See you, Catherine.
Bye.